From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a critique of the Senate Judiciary Committee's performance during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. We talk with lawyer David Carries, who has argued sexual and racial harassment cases in court. Also today, we talk with Dan Rather about how some politicians try to get even when they are unhappy with the questions you ask them. And world music critic Milo Miles reviews a new book that explores the world of the samba. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Authorities in Killeen, Texas, said that a man drove his truck through the window of a local cafeteria today and opened fire on people in the lunch line with two semi-automatic weapons. He killed at least 22 people before apparently turning one of the guns on himself. Gun control advocates pointed out that the killings took place as the House begins debate on an anti-crime bill that would ban semi-automatic assault weapons and ammunition magazines holding more than 7 rounds. The House is scheduled to vote tomorrow on an amendment by Missouri Democrat Harold Volkmer, which would remove the bans from the bill. The Senate failed today to override President Bush's veto of a bill that would have given millions of jobless Americans up to 20 more weeks of unemployment benefits. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senate Democrats were 2 votes short today of reversing the veto. President Bush quietly vetoed the bill last Friday when most of America's attention was riveted on the confirmation hearings of Clarence Thomas. The bill would have cost $6.4 billion and provided additional benefits for people whose basic 26 weeks of unemployment benefits have run out. Michigan Democrat Donald Riegel says his state is one of the most hard hit, but he says the administration has no understanding of the problem.
And it's all across my state, but it's in every one of the other 49 states. They are out of touch. They're in touch with problems in other countries. I mean, they've got an economic plan for every country in the world except this one.
Republicans had offered a more limited alternative, but Democrats have labeled it a last-minute sham. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The White House raised the possibility today that President Bush and Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev might attend the opening of a Middle East peace conference. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
As Secretary of State James Baker works out the final details of a peace conference with the participants in the Middle East, at the White House they're talking about whether President Bush will attend its opening. Certainly that's possible, said White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater. Mr. Bush himself sidestepped the question when it was put to him at a picture-taking session, saying he wants to do whatever will facilitate peace in the Middle East.
It's too long in coming, and so I hope that there will be a peace conference, and I hope that it will be the first major step towards peace in that part of the world.
A Bush-Gorbachev meeting would allow the two leaders to discuss in person U.S.-Soviet issues such as nuclear arms reduction. The president said there are no set plans for a peace conference yet, nor has it been determined who might attend. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
Stock prices closed at a record high today on Wall Street, climbing for the third day in a row. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 20 points to close at 3,061.72. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-3 in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 225 million shares. This is NPR News. The House voted today to support Senator Jesse Helms' prohibitions against government support for art that depicts what are determined to be patently offensive sexual themes. The 286-135 vote came as House and Senate negotiators are working on a compromise bill to fund the National Endowment for the Arts. The vote was non-binding, but it showed more than 2-1 support for a provision that was inserted into the Senate version by North Carolina Republican Jesse Helms. Similar language was thrown out of last year's Senate bill while the House and Senate versions were being reconciled. United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar today sharply condemned plans by the Khmer Rouge to forcibly relocate Cambodian refugees from Thai border camps this weekend. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
According to published reports, the Khmer Rouge guerrillas plan to force 200 Cambodians out of refugee camps back into Khmer-controlled territory inside Cambodia. The Khmer are said to need the refugees to build up their political base in time for nationwide elections in March 1993. Today, the UN Secretary General said the plans are deeply disturbing and threaten the UN-sponsored Cambodian peace accords, which are to be signed in Paris next week. UN officials have asked Thai troops to guard the camps to prevent any forced relocation. The Khmer are one of three guerrilla factions that participated in the UN-sponsored peace talks. The group controlled Cambodia for 3 years in the late 1970s when it was responsible for the deaths of several million Cambodian citizens. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The Federal Trade Commission has accused three companies of false advertising about their liquid diet products. The government said that Optifast, Medifast, and Ultrafast misled consumers with false claims about the safety of their liquid diets. The government said that the companies have been placed under agreement to replace unsubstantiated hype with documented facts. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the Senate confirmed the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. Never in the century has a vote for a court nominee been so close or left the country so divided. Anita Hill's allegations of sexual harassment were handled by the Senate Judiciary Committee differently than they would have been in a court of law. We were curious about those differences. David Carries is a Temple University law professor and editor of the book The Politics of Law. In his 20 years as a civil liberties lawyer, he has litigated cases involving sexual and racial harassment. Last year, Carries won an out-of-court settlement against the FBI in the Bureau's first case involving racial harassment. Carries says that although there are laws against sexual and racial harassment, and we as a society agree harassment is wrong, we don't necessarily understand the predicament of the complainant.
We as a culture have a lot of expectations about victims and about heroes. To me, for instance, Rosa Parks is a hero of the civil rights movement. Anita Hill is a victim who then showed heroic courage, I think, in coming forward and doing what she did. But victims are picked by other people or by chance. They happen to be in a certain place at a certain time. Something happens to them. It is very unfair, I think, and not very human in terms of expectations to expect a victim to, first of all, make all the decisions in her life as if raising a certain public issue is the only thing that's important.
What questions were you anxious to ask her that you didn't hear asked during the hearings?
The questions about concrete decisions, not on a big scale, not like why didn't you report it. What did you see as your choices at the point where he first harassed you? What did you see as your choices and why did you make the decision you made as we go down the line? Now she goes to the EEOC. Her connection to power and to these good jobs is Clarence Thomas. And she faces the same thing. She can try and move on when it starts up. She said it stopped for a long time, even prior to the move, and that's why she felt okay about going with him. She had no place else to go. And she again is in this situation where she could sacrifice that job if she reports it, probably not win, or go somewhere else. She gets a connection to Oral Roberts Law School. Now, this is really, to be honest, about the bottom of the heap as law schools go. Law teaching is very difficult to break into. She's made the connection through Clarence Thomas. To expect her at that point, when someone talks about Clarence Thomas at Oral Roberts Law School, and when the dean, as we heard in such elaborate detail, is in the process of writing a book basically saying that Clarence Thomas should be sainted, is she going to do we expect her, is really the question, to talk negatively about him? No. It would make no sense. It would also be embarrassing to say he harassed me then, but I didn't complain.
Let's talk about Clarence Thomas. The senators were trying to establish his credibility or lack of credibility. Clarence Thomas's approach was to just deny all the charges and to offer very little or virtually no information about himself beyond his denials. What questions might you have asked to get beyond those denials into more information?
All right. First, I would want to clarify exactly what his position was with regard to whether sexual harassment was a legitimate subject of inquiry. And I would have thought the senators would push him because his basic position seemed to be, and the position of the administration seemed to be, that even a credible allegation of sex harassment should simply be disregarded if it's made about a prominent man. This is a negation of the whole law of sex harassment. Itself could provide a basis for saying the man shouldn't sit on the Supreme Court.
What questions might you have asked to establish his credibility or his lack of credibility?
Okay. When you get to the basic problem that I think everybody watching these proceedings had, that they both seemed credible, the tendency of the 14 white male senators was to look to Anita Hill and say, can we find some psychological explanation why her story might not be true? And they asked numerous witnesses to speculate who had no basis at all about her perhaps being out of touch with reality. Instead, if you look at the record they had before them, I'm talking about the record of the previous confirmation hearings as well as the sex harassment, there was a clear pattern of denial and evasion of clearly established facts by Clarence Thomas. He was, for many years, one of the primary spokespeople for the far right. There's no question about that. There's piles of speeches that the senators had in front of them. He managed to take a kind of a grand denial strategy. And there's a question of whether you view this as a psychological, part of his psychological makeup, his personality, or if one prefers a less psychological explanation, it's just the strategy that he and the spin doctors at the White House came up with. In either event, really, or it could be both, what he did was to basically deny the essential fact that he had taken these positions. He would not and was not pushed by the Democratic senators clarify whether his position was actually different. In other words, when he praised Lewis Lehrman's speech, he should have been pushed, do you agree with Lewis Lehrman's speech? Do you disagree? If you've changed since then, why have you changed, etc.? In the situation about abortion, the man not only denied having a position or taking any formal position, he denied ever discussing it with anyone. This is a grand denial. This is an evasion. This is a failure to deal with reality, if one wishes to look at it in the same terms that it seemed to be pressed on Anita Hill. These could have been developed, I think, quite easily.
Some people said that Anita Hill seemed too controlled and too unemotional to be credible. I wonder what your reaction was to that. And when you've defended people who charged sexual harassment, what did you tell them about how emotional to be on the stand?
It's a very difficult issue. Part of it has to do with the expectations in our culture about victims. We expect victims to be extremely and eternally suffering. They are supposed to exude suffering and pain. Now, the reality is when people get hurt, even if when they get hurt very seriously, either physically or psychologically or both, there are mechanisms of healing. You do find ways to go on with the rest of your life, and hopefully the people close to you help you do that. The people around you encourage you to do that. So what happens is whatever the mechanisms are, and they're different for different people, you can block parts of it. You can repress, depending if you tend to a Freudian explanation, but you lose the immediacy and the direct consciousness with that immense pain, as you must to function in the rest of your life. It's like people who have lost a loved one, so that one has to call it up and one has to decide whether to call it up. Now, this is one of the difficult problems in any kind of harassment case, whether it's sexual or racial or anything like that, or to some extent in any kind of victim case. You, as the lawyer in my position, have to encourage the client not to exaggerate or not to cry on demand. That's not the problem. The problem that the person will feel is, if I call this up, if I let this out, I can't control it. I have learned how to control it. I have fought hard. The tears still come once in a while, but I basically can function. So you have to say to the person, you have to let it out in order to show the onlookers, to some extent, it's their expectation. But to have to do that, particularly in a case where she never decided to go ahead with this, I mean, it was really, she was quite reluctant all the way. And there she is thrust not only in front of a court and a jury, but in front of the entire nation and expected to basically act hysterical, is one way you could think of it, to tap in to the pain that she felt.
Anita Hill said that Clarence Thomas would talk to her about pornography and Long Dong Silver. Would, as a civil liberties lawyer, who I'm sure you believe that what somebody watches in the privacy of their own home is their own business.
Certainly.
Would you have brought up with Clarence Thomas, if you were questioning him, if he in fact watched a lot of pornography? Or would you have not brought that up, thinking that that's just not really relevant, that's a private issue?
I would have attempted to draw a line between whether he watched anything, which I think is perfectly his business and has nothing to do with his qualifications to be a Supreme Court justice, and what pornography or other matters of a potentially offensive nature he imposed on others. But I certainly would not be letting up on what he imposed on others. The summaries, which was not merely towards Anita Hill. There was other evidence in the record about it that the Democrats were too afraid to touch.
But you would not have questioned him about if he goes to the video store and rents pornography, if he used to enjoy pornography in college. You wouldn't have gotten
I personally that. Wouldn't have. There are others, I'd have to say, who also have similar litigation experience to me who you might get a different answer from.
My guest is civil liberties lawyer David Carries. He's a law professor at Temple University. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Civil liberties lawyer David Carries is my guest. You used to head up something called the Jury Selection Project, and I know you've given a lot of thought to how to select a fair jury. What went through your mind when you saw people who are involved in partisan politics being the jury for a sexual harassment case, which is what part of this boiled down to?
Yes. Well, I have worked with a group called the National Jury Project, which is still functioning quite well. And, of course, the prospect of trying a sex harassment case to 14 middle-aged or upper-aged white males is quite difficult. It seems to me that the Democrats, and this I lodge at them, should have realized that they were somewhat out of their element here. They also had some particular personal problems that made it difficult for them to take an active role. And this would have led me to think that they should, first of all, consult someone who knows about sex harassment cases. So you know that there's going to be a blaming the victim strategy. It always emerges in defense of the man charged with sex harassment. You have to be ready to deal with that. You have to have somebody who can both defend the victim, Anita Hill, and with due respect, but in a very straightforward and somewhat aggressive manner, force Clarence Thomas to answer the relevant questions.
The charges of sexual harassment were heard before the Senate Judiciary Committee, not a court of law. And there's a difference between how a Senate committee and a court will handle the charges. Many senators brought up the issue of who had the burden of proof, mm-hmm. And what a lot of the senators were saying was Clarence Thomas should be innocent until proven guilty. And if there's a shadow of a doubt about his guilt, then he is innocent and he should be confirmed. Since this was not a court of law, but a Senate committee, I was wondering as a lawyer who works in a court of law, mm-hmm. what you thought about, innocence and guilt, and who had the burden of proof and so on.
Well, we're not talking about a crime. So to think in terms of reasonable doubt makes no sense. This was really a proceeding where the issue is one's fitness to the Supreme Court. And the question of whether to affirm or not affirm is the question.
In a sexual harassment case in a court of law, if there is a shadow of a doubt about the guilt of the party charged with sexual harassment, then they'd be innocent, yes?
Well, it depends if it's amounting to a crime. These cases usually aren't criminal cases. Usually the person making the allegations would have to prove by what's called a preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt, but basically to prove it's more likely than not that it occurred. That's the most burden that I could imagine fairly being appropriate to this case. But the question that was relevant for them is, should Clarence Thomas be confirmed as a justice of the Supreme Court? If they come to believe at any point in the proceedings and after it's over, weighing all of the evidence they heard and putting aside any irrelevant considerations in their mind, they believe that he engaged in sex harassment of this serious a nature, I think they should vote against confirmation.
Anita Hill said that she was sexually harassed. Clarence Thomas said that he was being lynched for being an uppity black. As a white man who has who has worked with people who have filed sexual harassment suits and racial discrimination suits, how did you weigh those charges of sexual harassment and racial discrimination?
There's a very popular Black Studies book that's used in women's Black Studies courses. And the title is All the Women Are White, All the Blacks Are Men, But Some of Us Are Brave. What it says, and I think it's quite poignant, we as a society view sex discrimination as a problem that focuses on white women. We view race discrimination as a problem that focuses on black men. Where does this leave black women?
I believe the Supreme Court has a sexual harassment case coming up very soon. do you think that Judge Thomas should exempt himself from this case?
No. No, I think one's experience and one's life, he doesn't have a pending charge against him. He doesn't... He's not involved, I don't think, in that particular case, then that wouldn't, I don't think that would be required.
What do you mean he's not involved in that case?
I mean, he has no particular connection to that case. If he once served as a lawyer or if it came through the EEOC, I don't know. If it came through the EEOC when he was there, that could result in him recusing himself. But too much gets used in that idea in a very general way that I think is very illegitimate. For instance, I've seen white lawyers move to disqualify a black judge from hearing a race discrimination case. The theory, presumably, is he might know too much. no, I don't think that would be appropriate. There's one on this this issue of black women. There is a history there that really does get too little attention. One example of it, in the early 1900s, it used to be extremely relevant in rape prosecutions whether the woman was chaste. This was the legal term.
Chaste with an E?
Exactly. Chastity.
Chastity, yes.
Chastity was a relevant concern, the presumption being that if a woman had slept with someone, then she wasn't raped by the person who's charged with raping her. A ridiculous assumption, of course. But there was a presumption as to white women in the law that that they were chaste. And so to the extent it became relevant in a trial, the other side had to try and prove the lack of chastity of a white woman. Fairly regularly in American courts, that presumption was not extended to black women.
Do you think that the process of confirming a Supreme Court justice should be reformed?
Well, this is the difficulty. We are different than even the other Western democracies, which are culturally similar to us, in the way we regard law. Law takes over such a broad range of disputes and controversies in our society, and to me, and to a large extent, replaces politics. It's one of the reasons that we have such a low level, in my mind, of political discourse and such low interest among the people in political issues and even in electoral issues. What we've done is turn over virtually everything to the courts. If we're going to do that, it seems to me that we have every right to inquire in detail, particularly about their approaches, not necessarily about more aspects of their personal life, although I think sexual harassment is certainly a relevant and pertinent question. I think they are up there on that court applying values. And if we're going to turn over all these decisions to them, we need to know those values. And I would think justice or nominated justice who won't answer such questions, such as the last two, I think should be voted no just on that ground.
What about the process itself? Would you like to see the process changed? Or do you think the process works okay?
Well, there was something very ugly about this second batch of hearings. There's no question. On the other hand, sex harassment is ugly. And any proceeding about it is ugly. Even those conducted pursuant to the rules of evidence in a court of law, there would be some difference. Senator Spector might get laughed at for some of his questions about FBI reports or his claim of perjury. He might get lectured by the judge because it was preposterous. He couldn't say those things in front of a jury. Senator Hatch couldn't quote from The Exorcist. So there was a little bit of extra theatrics. But the basic point and the basic ugliness of it, I have to say, would not be much different.
Why wouldn't Senator Hatch have been allowed to introduce The Exorcist and the quote about the pubic hair in the gin if it were a court of law instead of a Senate Judiciary Committee?
You'd have to show some connection. It would be prejudicial. You'd have to show that she read it, that it had some connection to the case. As I understand it, in that instance, Professor Catherine McKinnon, who's a law professor who's written a lot about sex harassment and done really some very important work, submitted an affidavit late in the process saying that the story about the Coke can and the pubic hair, I believe, actually comes from a porno film. And that would raise the prospect that Clarence Thomas saw it. So that shifts it as to it helping Anita Hill's credibility and hurting Clarence Thomas's credibility. Well, in both instances, I mean, if you couldn't establish that, say, he had seen that particular film or that she had read The Exorcist, it's so speculative that I think most judges would keep it out. And it's potentially damaging.
In your critique of how the senators behaved as lawyers, what are some of the things you thought were out of bounds or cheap tricks?
Well, the cheapest to me was my own Senator Spector, using the word perjury. He's a former prosecutor. He knew quite well, he's a quite bright man, that is totally inappropriate. What Anita Hill had said, she had couched with, "I'm not sure, I'm not really remembering a lot on that issue." It was a side issue. As he asked her more, she said, "Well, I'm remembering a little more about that. There might have been a discussion that had something to do with that." There is no possible way in the world of getting a perjury indictment or conviction on testimony like that, and Arlen Specter knew it.
David Karas, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Karas is a civil liberties lawyer and a professor of law at Temple University. He edited the book, The Politics of Law. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1981, Dan Rather replaced Walter Cronkite as the anchor of the CBS Evening News. Coming up, we talk with Rather about his role as journalist and media star. And world music critic Milo Miles reviews a book about the samba and how it shapes every part of Brazilian culture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. One day after winning confirmation of U.S. Supreme Court nominee Judge Clarence Thomas, President Bush has sent another nomination to the U.S. Senate. The president today nominated William Barr as U.S. Attorney General. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Barr has spent the past 3 years at the Justice Department, where he was most recently Deputy Attorney General. He became Acting Attorney General in August when Dick Thornburgh left to run for the Senate in Pennsylvania. Previously, Barr worked as an attorney in private practice and spent 4 years as a counsel at the CIA. Today, President Bush praised Barr as a man he respects enormously.
And I have chosen an individual who was a thorough professional, a defender of individual rights, and a person absolutely committed to this fight against crime.
Barr, who is 41, received praise for his work to quell a recent disturbance by Cuban inmates at the Talladega prison in Alabama. Once more, it will be the Senate Judiciary Committee in the spotlight as they will hold confirmation hearings into the nomination. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
In central Texas, a man today drove his truck through the window of a cafeteria and opened fire on people waiting in line for their lunch. Police say that 22 people were killed before the gunman killed himself. Officials say a number of other people were wounded in the shooting in Killeen, Texas, at Luby's Cafeteria. A worker at the cafeteria said that the gunman shouted before he started firing, "This is what Bell County has done to me." It was not Roe versus Wade, but still the abortion case argued today before the U.S. Supreme Court is a controversial one that's being closely watched. At issue, whether federal judges can prevent blockades to abortion clinics. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Lawyers for abortion rights activists argue that blockades prevent women from exercising their right to abortion. Lower courts have ruled in their favor, upholding the belief that women as a group are being discriminated against. Lawyers for anti-abortion groups say that's not true, arguing the blockades prevent everyone, not just women, from entering abortion clinics. Therefore, they say blockade cases should be handled as trespassing issues on the state and local level. Allison Weatherfield, attorney for the Now Legal Defense Fund, disagrees.
Clinics may go into state court to get injunctions against trespass. We are here today because women have no rights in those state courts to go in to argue that their federal rights are being infringed.
The Bush administration joined Operation Rescue in arguing that clinic blockades don't discriminate against women. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 20 points to close at a new record high of 3,061.72, volume 225 million shares. This is NPR News. As expected, the U.S. Senate has sustained a presidential veto of a bill to extend unemployment benefits for people who are out of work. The measure would have provided from 7 to 20 extra weeks of coverage to people who have used up their basic 26 weeks of jobless benefits. The vote of 65 to 35 was only two votes short of the two-thirds needed to override. All 57 Democrats and 8 Republicans voted for the measure. It was the second time in 2 months that the president has killed a Democratic-written expansion of jobless coverage. France and Germany have proposed the creation of a defense force to be built up from an existing Franco-German brigade. This proposal has been rejected by Britain, which wants Western Europe to stay firmly anchored in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The proposal calls for strengthening the existing Franco-German brigade, which was set up 2 years ago and consists of about 4,500 men. It says other countries in the Western European Union, a nine-nation group that only has European members, could join the force. The proposal said the expanded brigade could form the nucleus of a European army, which news reports say could have as many as 100,000 men. The Franco-German proposal also calls for the creation of a framework for a common EC defense policy. The idea is that EC countries would follow single policies on certain issues, including relations with the United States, the Soviet Union, and the Middle East. This proposal comes 2 months before EC leaders are to meet in the Netherlands to decide on economic and political unity. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Officials of the U.S. oil industry have told Congress that firefighters have capped over 580 of the burning oil wells in Kuwait. There had been close to 700 wells burning in all. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1981, Dan Rather moved into the anchor chair at CBS Evening News. He replaced America's best-loved anchor, Walter Cronkite, who virtually owned the top-rated spot among network news shows. Rather came to the job with a reputation as a combative reporter. He was in Dallas when President Kennedy was shot and was the first to report that he had died. Rather covered the civil rights movement, was in Vietnam during the war, and was the chief White House correspondent during Watergate. Dan Rather has just written a memoir of his boyhood in Texas called I Remember. Over the past few days, some people have said that televising the latter part of the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings turned them into a circus. Rather says, as painful as the hearings were to watch, it was important for the American public to see them. But he expressed concerns about how the White House and Senate handled the confirmation process.
Well, I think cynicism is a real problem. I am dedicated to the proposition that a good journalist must be skeptical, but never cynical. The same thing, I think, applies certainly the dangers of cynicism, and perhaps even in larger, more important quantity, does it apply to our political process. That part of what's happened to the political process is deepening cynicism. You'd say, oh, well, listen, cynicism's been a part of politics since before the ancient Greeks, and I would say, yes, that's true. But you can reach a point where it's too pervasive, it penetrates too deeply. And what the events of surrounding this Supreme Court nomination say to me is I think we're very near that point or perhaps beyond it. Let me give you an example. And let me pause and say this is personal opinion clearly labeled. When President Bush said that Clarence Thomas was the best qualified person in America for this Senate seat, I think it unleashed, rightly or wrongly, justifiably or otherwise, it unleashed a good deal of cynicism. And that can build on itself. Frankly, there's plenty of blame to go around in this whole mess, and I do not exclude journalists from our part in what turned out to be a debacle. But a lot of it has to do with cynicism. Cynicism in appointments, cynicism in the approval or disapproval process, and yes, some cynicism in the press. And I only hope that we can sort of crawl back to some level where there's skepticism but not cynicism in everything from the nomination itself through the process and through the coverage of the process.
I believe on Saturday CBS had a game that it had to go to. Were you frustrated that CBS couldn't do complete coverage of the hearings on Saturday because of the game?
No, frustration is not the word. Listen, I'm a reporter. I'm a lifetime reporter, and I always want news to take precedent. But I understood well before we began covering the hearings and all during the hearings that we had CBS Incorporated, not CBS News, but CBS Incorporated, had a legally binding contract to cover sports events. Unfortunately, these sports events coincided with these very important hearings. And while I certainly wish that it could have been otherwise and left strictly to myself, probably would have tried to make some other call, I understood that it was a legally binding contract and we had to do it. And also, I work at CBS and I'm loyal to CBS.
I want to ask you about an incident that I'm sure a lot of our listeners remember, and I'm sure it's something you've been asked about a lot. I'm thinking of the 1988 interview that you did live with then-Vice President George Bush, who was a candidate for president at the time. CBS had been negotiating with Bush to do an interview, for you to do an interview with him, and I believe it was Bush's idea to have the interview live. What did you think were the advantages and the disadvantages to you and to him by going live?
Well, first, the main advantage to us for going live, it's the only way we could get the interview.
That was the condition.
That was a condition of the interview. It was not our preference, but we considered it carefully and said, well, there are risks in doing the interview live. And I fully understood then, and I understand now, that there are people who say, oh, well, you should never do an interview live. But it was the only way we could get the interview. I thought it was important that we interview the vice president and candidate for the presidency. So we made a judgment. We took our chances. We went live with it. Then and now, I'm proud of the fact that we did.
What did you think were the greatest risks to you?
Well, there's always, to me, I don't think of risks to myself.
Well, a risk to the program.
Risk to the program is that there's always a risk of filibuster that with any political candidate, that if you do it live, that the candidate tries to filibuster through whatever time he thinks you may have and not answer the questions.
Mm-hmm. And then you'll look rude if you keep interrupting.
And not be seen answering the questions. Well, I am at peace with anyone who actually saw and heard the interview or has taken the time to go back and take a look at the videotape of the interview. Look, like anyone else, I make my mistakes. I'd like to think that I'm not a rude person. I was not rude in that interview.
Oh, I didn't say you were rude.
No. I wasn't taking offense. I was just saying, you said, well, or appear to be rude, I think you said, if you ask the questions. Now, frankly, I was surprised by many things in the interview. One of the things I wanted to do in the interview was try to get the answer to the question, how was it that the Ayatollah Khomeini had killed 242 of our very best young men, most of the Marines, in the Beirut barracks. He murdered them. He killed them. 242. And then we learn that we immediately after that began sending thousands of our best, most sophisticated missiles to the Ayatollah. Now, it was an unexplained, I couldn't understand it. And I had known George Bush for many years. And frankly, I thought he would come with an explanation. So one of the things I wanted to do in the interview is get the explanation for him of why we were doing this. He didn't have an answer. He did his job as he saw it as a candidate for president. He tried to avoid the question. I think I did my job as a reporter, which was to keep asking the question either until I got an answer or that it was clear that he wasn't going to answer the question. Now, one can argue about whether I did a good job or a poor job of it, but that's what I was trying to do.
Dan Rather is my guest, and he's written a memoir about his youth. It's called I Remember. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with CBS News anchor Dan Rather about his now famous live interview with presidential candidate George Bush in 1988. I think it's fair to say that Bush tried to make it seem like you were almost ambushing him to get him to talk about Iran-Contra and that you were being unfair in your line of questioning. There was a lot of speculation after this interview that the goal of the White House in this interview was to show that George Bush was not a wimp. He could really stand up to Dan Rather live on television.
Well, I don't believe that.
Did you think that was the ultimate goal?
No, I didn't. First of all, having said that I knew George Bush for a long time, I don't think anybody who knew George Bush had what you describe in their mind. I don't think it was even a very viable factor in the campaign. It could very well be that President Bush's handlers thought he was weak or unable to handle things. I didn't come there to ambush anybody. I'm aware that for their own partisan, political, and in some cases ideological purposes, there was an effort made by those around the vice president, whether he was involved himself or not, I don't know, to convince people that an ambush had been planned. For example, Time magazine suckered for that story in an almost unbelievable way, led by, I'm told, a man who was supposed to be covering the campaign for Time magazine, who later became the press spokesman in a high place in the administration. So I have to ask myself, what was going on then? And you know what? I didn't know then, and I don't know now. I know that I walked in to that interview trying to do my best as a lifetime professional reporter to ask questions and to be professional. I did my best to do so.
Was CBS punished by the White House after your interview with George Bush?
The direct answer to that is yes. I pause only because I'm not sure punishment is the right word, that we paid a price for it.
What was the price?
But before we move to what the price was, it's very important to me that you understand, the audience understands. I have no complaints. It goes with the territory. Now, you say, what was the price? Among the price, if you would go back and check, in the last week of the campaign, there were two big interviews given with the candidate for president, Vice President George Bush. They were given to our competitors. They were not given to CBS News. CBS News was shut out in the last week of the campaign. You can check the record that since election as president, that President Bush has given interviews to, I think, every major over-the-air news broadcasting organization. There's been one notable exception, notable to me at least, and that has been CBS News. Again, no complaints. This goes with the territory. The message has been, when I covered City Hall, state legislature, the Congress, and the White House in years past, the message always is, if you come with independence, if you try to be an independent reporter and engage in independent coverage, sooner or later, partisan politicians and or ideologues will try to make you pay the price. It goes with the territory. That's part of what being a reporter is about.
Do you think that that technique is effective in getting reporters to go easy on politicians?
Yes, the record is very clear. It's one of the things that's happened with American journalism in recent years. The message from the politicians, and by the way, this is whether, generally speaking, whether the Democrats, Republicans, mugwumps or whatever, is you give me favorable coverage. You give that to me and you'll get yours. You'll get the big interview or I'll put in a good word with your boss or who knows, as was the case with the Time magazine man I mentioned, you may even get a job with the administration when we get elected. Now, for many years, the mainstream of American journalism set a standard that said, you only have one client. This is the journalism I was reared on. You only have one client. The client is the viewer or the listener, that person in the living room or driving along the car who's depending on you to bring independent journalism, independent reportage to them. Your job is not to be curry favor. Now, there's been a shift in the last 10 or 12 years that even with some of our finest newspapers and even with some of our best broadcast organizations, the standard has become your first job, Mr. Reporter, is to be popular with the person you are covering or the institution or group. That's a major shift in journalism, and I do think that shift has taken place. I'm hopeful that the shift is not permanent, and it won't last long.
Is there a specific story that you think the American public missed out on because of this emphasis on favorable courage to curry favor?
I think the overall story of our economy is probably the best example, the best running example. And again, I want to make it clear that I think in many ways this applies to those covering Democrats as well as to Republicans. Look, the economic situation has been and is, in some ways, of more concern, has deeper problems than has generally been reported. So I think that's one example. I think there have been other examples. I think the 1988 political campaign, and I do not accept myself, I do not accept CBS News, that in general, coverage in the 1988 political campaign was spineless, gutless, and thoughtless. And that's not something we as journalists can be proud of. And I place the most responsibility for that on those newspapers and broadcast organizations that over the years and through their history have set the highest standards for quality and excellence. I think in many ways we let ourselves down in 1988.
Dan Rather is my guest. You know what I think a lot of Americans have become skeptical about? Anchors going on location during a crisis. Examples would include the San Francisco earthquake and more recently the war in the Gulf. And I'm sure you heard a lot of people talking, you know, cynically about the TV anchors getting into their Banana Republic clothes and flying into the Gulf to be there for the war. What's your impression about when it's appropriate for an anchor to be on location, and why is it important that an anchor be there?
Well, first, let me deal with your premise that the talk about, quote, being in Banana Republic clothes, unquote. I generally hear that mostly, if not entirely, from other journalists who are envious that you get to go someplace or you get to go to the cutting edge of a story. I don't hear many of our viewers or listeners talking about it. Now, as to the question of why one wants to go, listen, being a reporter is the only thing I've ever wanted to do in my life. Never thought about being an anchorman. Never even thought about being in broadcasting. And you can say, well, you're a long way from that now, and that's true. But I think of myself professionally as a reporter first and then an anchor person. What kind of reporter would I be if I said, listen, we're going to send maybe 750,000 of our sons and daughters and brothers and husbands and wives and our best young people to fight a war 10,000 miles away from home, but I'm not going to go see it and report it firsthand as best I can. I don't think I would have been worthy of the title reporter, which I consider the best title I have. I wouldn't be worthy of the name of journalist, much less anchor, if I didn't do that.
Dan Rather. He's written a new memoir about growing up in Texas. It's called I Remember. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Noah, what do you have today on our next Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas?
A couple of stories. An assessment of the Supreme Court season that lies ahead now that Thurgood Marshall has been replaced with Clarence Thomas. David Mopus reports on what the Senate vote yesterday means for several Southern Democrats who supported Judge Thomas. We'll also be asking what effect the confirmation vote has on the issue of sexual harassment. According to a new study, suicide rates among farmers have been running at a rate that is about twice that for other occupations. Also, a conversation with Russell Banks. He's written a new novel called The Sweet Hereafter about a school bus accident in a mythical town in upstate New York.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Books on popular music will often tell you which records to buy, what a style of music sounds like, and how it feels to hear it. Only a few books bring to life the culture that surrounds the music, and even fewer explain how the music nourishes the people who play it and dance to it. World music commentator Milo Miles has found such a book in Alma Guillaume-Prieto's Samba.
Alma Guillaume-Prieto is a New Yorker correspondent who spent most of the 1980s in Rio de Janeiro, where she soon noticed something curious. The issue of race is at least as charged and intriguing in Brazil as it is in the United States. Discrimination is a fact of life in Rio, despite Brazil's reputation as a land with a relaxed attitude about black, brown, and white. Reportedly, you see black people on American television much more often than on Brazilian TV. except, of course, during the middle of February when the Samba Carnival festivities are broadcast 4 days straight. The carnival captivates the city and much of the country while it's on. Guillermo Prieto discovered that Samba does much more for the inhabitants of the numerous slums that cling to the steep hills surrounding Rio. For these slums, called favelas, Samba is a kind of organizing axis for social life. It's bigger than Christmas, Halloween, and the Super Bowl rolled together. Each favela sponsors a so-called Samba school. Each school consists of hundreds of singing dancers decked in racy, gaudy, canny costumes, and a band to play the Samba they have selected, and a series of spectacular floats based on that year's theme, which nowadays usually involves pointed political satire and expressions of black pride. Guillermo Prieto notes, however, that the year she danced at the carnival, there was a set of floats dedicated to just cows. Samba music and the parade itself have an intricate, extensive background, and Guillermo Prieto details all that. She's far more drawn into how the approaching carnival weaves into the minds and daily activities of the people in a particular favela named Mangueria. Of course, winning first place in the carnival competition gives a school bragging rights among favelas for a whole year. Even so, simply mounting a Samba presentation is as important as who wins. Samba Carnival is the most powerful legitimate expression available to these communities who are so poor that street sweeping is a furiously sought-after job. Samba Carnival is the most spectacular public way for scorned ethnic groups to trumpet their own history, their own heroes and goddesses, and to leave a social legacy for their children. According to Guillermo Prieto, Samba helps people that seem to come from nowhere keep from disappearing into nothing. In this passage, she describes the penetrating delight of a young boy who only wants to sit still and wear his first glorious Samba outfit. Washington Luiz smiled inwardly to himself, only occasionally bending slightly to let his gaze travel from the moccasins up to his chest, which was how, in the absence of any mirror, he could look on himself and see his body clothed in the costume of a dream world, that is, of the real world, where events happen and are remembered, where lives move forward rather than repetitively around themselves, where things look the way they're supposed to and actions have consequences, the world of which Mangueria, with its trash and rags and open sewers and leaking roofs, is not a part.
Abre a roda, malungo, abre a roda, malungo, abre a roda, malungo, olere.
Guillermo Prieto introduces a dozen vibrant characters for whom escape and transcendence are hard to separate. They all persevere by exile and cunning. Perhaps the most striking is the aged Selena, a woman who is occasionally possessed by the sinister ghost of a male gangster who talks in a rasping growl and stares with cold yellow eyes. All that might be asked to complete the portrait of Samba in Rio is a man's account, since unlike the loquacious women, the males of Mangueria were not very interested in talking to a female journalist. For men and women, preparations for Samba Carnival involve lots of long practice sessions for performers and thousands of dollars and thousands of hours to assemble the costumes and floats. Some will say that Samba is sequin-spattered opiate for the masses, a regulated release valve that lets the oppressed strut their stuff for a little while rather than to concentrate their energies on achieving substantial political clout. And there's something to that notion. Yet Guillermo Prieto makes a splendid case for Samba Carnival as a great edifice of the spirit, a palace of soul as uplifting as any white millionaire's mansion on a hill.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed Samba, published by Vintage. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with associate producers Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He gave the world Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk, and plenty of other superheroes. In the next edition of Fresh Air, we talk with comic book writer, editor, and publisher Stan Lee. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.